Hello, I'm Paul Yeager, and this is the MTOM Podcast, a production of Iowa Public Television. Twitter can be the equalizer when it comes to distributing information. Everyone gets the same amount of characters, but how you use them is what sorts the good from the average. Matthew Pott has made a name for himself on the medium, and it comes mostly from what he visually posts to the site, while breaking down the markets from his home country of Canada. We discuss trade issues with information on the dairy industry, soybeans, and how he may become a market analyst for our program in a new, highly talked about commodity. You've seen him on Twitter, and we've retweeted him a bunch, so let's, just like Phil in Canada is real, Matthew Pott in Canada is real. Is that right, Matthew?
Yeah, I'm a real person. How are you today, Paul?
I'm doing fantastic. So you're in Ontario as well. What city are you closest to?
I'm closest to Hamilton, so it's practically Toronto to some extent, if you're looking big picture.
Well, how long have you lived there?
Oh, I've moved all over the place. Here, about a year.
Okay.
Just over. And then I lived in Guelph, Woodstock. Actually, I lived on the Western Coast back about 10 years ago, too, in Victoria, BC. Quite beautiful. So I guess little diverse locations that I've lived in.
What takes you from one town to another? Just that free Canadian spirit of wanting to travel the country?
Opportunities is always what it ends up being, right? So, you know, it's just like agriculture has so much opportunities here. And you always find yourself moving to benefit from those opportunities. Always on the road myself, too. So I always like to try and find somewhere that's central as well and close to, easy access across Ontario.
Where
you don't have to go around Toronto, which is a big pain, right?
Do you call Toronto traffic terrible?
Toronto, as far as I know, we would have the busiest highway in North America, the 401. Essentially, realistically, what that is the only highway that goes through Ontario. We have in the big picture, through Ontario is the only long one. But just through Toronto, that can take hours to get through that city at any time, right? I mean, a rush hour, you best not even try.
Right. But everybody's nice during the rush hour, aren't they? I mean, you've got this reputation of being this incredibly nice country. I mean, is rush hour a mean rush hour? I mean, like, you've been to the United States and some of these areas, or you hear about them, you see them in movies where everybody's just angry with one another. You know, Seattle, they just get upset and furious with one another. That doesn't happen in Toronto, does it?
No, basically everybody lines up on the lane and then we all just take turns. And sometimes the highway's empty for a while because nobody's really sure if it's their turn to go or not, right? So
you don't need traffic lights. You just need a really polite person from Manitoba who's into the city.
Just give hand signals.
That'd be great. You are listed as an economist. That's your first word in your Twitter bio. What's that mean for you? What do you do?
I like to look at markets in an economic standpoint from a behavior, just kind of summarize everything. From education and profession, I'm an economist with research that I've done and my master's degree in, I guess, Canadian Securities Institute certifications too. So here in Canada, and why I label myself as an economist, just like any analyst, I'll talk about grain and whatever else. I tend to like to have an economic swing on that. But in Canada, the Canadian dollar's key for prices. You know, a 1 cent move in the Canadian dollar, when your futures price is based on U.S. dollars, you kind of get what that means, right?
Right.
It's huge changes in exchange rate. So what I like to discuss, in addition to corn, soybeans, and wheat, which are my main three commodities that I discuss, is what's happening big picture with the Canadian dollar, right? And also what that actually means to grain prices to some instant. Like, you know, the U.S. dollar in itself affects futures prices in the U.S., right? Or in Chicago. Now, here, our cash prices are in Canadian dollars, so kind of looking at the relationship between the currencies, what's your big risk? And realistically right now, as a result of these the interest rate stories that we always hear about from the Federal Reserve, here we have the Bank of Canada, too, where realistically the U.S. and Canada are the only two economies that are really aggressively advancing or increasing rates to try and control inflation, right? So that's the main focus that I have to focus on as such, is because with a loose traded currency like the Canadian dollar, interest rates are essentially key to the demand of the currency, right? So when you're talking about the Federal Reserve in grain markets and whatever, it's, I guess, it's less applicable than what it would be here even, because that Federal Reserve, the difference between interest rates can quickly change our Canadian dollar and our basis, right? We use Chicago futures, and in our basis for, is reflected on what the currency is. So we can talk about, you know, basis in U.S. dollars, but at the end of the day, the farmers here are getting paid in Canadian, and the exporters are shipping it out in U.S. dollars, right?
Right. So that, so then you have to study the United States just as much as you do Canada government and currencies to be able to understand. Is that frustrating at all? Because don't you think, gosh, why do I have to worry about those other countries? Why can't I just worry about my own?
Well, it was easier until about 2 years ago when you have this wild card in place that you're always trying to understand. And, you know, your president can make things a little bit difficult, especially when it comes down to the Canadian dollar. We've got so many things going on, not as much anymore now that we've came up with some trade agreement. But before, anything Trump would say could quickly change our currency, right? And it's
ours
all part
as well.
Of the job. Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that we've had to watch. You know, just the day that we're recording this, there was a release of an announcement of, oh, yeah, the Chinese president and the U.S. president chatted and beans went up 25 cents. So, I mean, absolutely, we see it in this country. And you saw that as well today.
Right. And, you know, what we need to ask ourselves, too, is like, Paul, this isn't the first time we heard this. It's almost becoming like a cry wolf. To some extent, it just seems like Trump or China and the U.S. in general always seem to have optimism, and, you know, we slowly go up like an escalator and we fall like an elevator each time. That's what it feels like. So hopefully the good news is that this actually means we'll keep on going up on the escalator. But to me right now, I don't know, you tell me, Paul, is it a flip of a coin or is this actually going to lead anywhere?
I don't know. We know that this is right around election time, so anything goes. That's how we view it. Which do you pay attention more to? I mean, yes, you're tied to the United States, but how much do you look at what's going on in China to help understand economies?
You kind of have to follow China, too. This is, and I think that's going to become more applicable in the long run. This whole global economic picture could flip like a could flip really fast. We've seen it all the time where we're at really low unemployment rates right now in Canada and the U.S. And if you pull up a chart like that, how quickly those unemployment rates can skyrocket based on, you know, global recessions or global economic conditions. And we are due for something like that. And China is relatively interesting, especially given the economic effects that this trade war has on it, too. So, but those type of situations can come up pretty randomly, but China is always interesting to watch. I mean, China copper prices are always key for commodities in general and et cetera. So I think when it comes down to it, we're following, or I'd be following, the exact same things that a U.S. analyst would follow in China in the big picture, right?
Right. So do you have sources?
Which is trying to guess what kind of numbers for their grain stocks are real.
That's what I was just going to say. What do you use for sources to determine what's real and what's fact and what's fiction when it comes to China for you?
Right.
What are some sources that you look at?
I think when real demand comes, that's fact.
Okay. That's fair.
Right, but
that's easy enough to answer. You mentioned charts. One of the things that I always like about your Twitter feed, Matt, is how you lay out the grains, the livestock, the outside markets in a nice visual sense. When did you start doing that, and why?
About, I guess it would be around 2 years ago, I really started doing the infographic side of things and kind of spent more time on my daily report, which is now pretty much my sole product, and kind of moved away from consulting. Or I still consult, right? Mm-hmm. But I spend a lot more time on my report now. And the idea with those visuals is I try to make it intuitive. My belief is that if, you know, we can talk as smart as we want and we could be 100% right all the time as an analyst, which never really happens.
Yeah, when did that happen? Yeah.
But let's say in theory, that's not beneficial for a producer necessarily unless they understand why they're making that decision, right? Or trust it. And I think when you make visuals or try to make your charts easy to see the main points, you kind of can help people intuitively see the big picture and what that could mean for their grain prices, right? We can talk moving averages and whatever all we want, but I mean, realistically, if a producer doesn't understand that, what good does that, what good is that for him or her to assess their risks or opportunities?
Right. And I will say that, John Roach, our senior market analyst, he always talks about the moving average, the 30, the 60, and there are sites where you can see that. But yours usually is the 30-day, and I always look at that to just see, because I'm not in it as deep as you are. But it always is a reminder to say, oh, yeah, spring wheat, by golly, we're on the low side of that 30-day average. Oh, we're really high on hogs right now because we've had it. So that's always just a good, quick thing for people to see. You focus heavily corn, soybean, and wheat. Is that fair?
That's correct.
And any truth to the rumor that we're adding you as our senior weed analyst for the show? I'm going to get my boss's attention as I say that. Let's talk marijuana a little bit up there. That is something that we've got ballot initiatives across the United States on Tuesday that are about marijuana. But here you're going all in Canada. What's that? What started that?
Well, the Trudeau government really pushed it. And, you know, what it comes down to is that the decriminalization really, when, like, Hamilton would be about just about 500,000 population, that city. And I believe prior to legalization, we would have had 23 decriminalized dispensaries actually selling weed, right?
Okay.
And so you could go in there and you could buy anything from edibles and whatever else. And it kind of comes to the point, especially when you have edibles, as far as I know, it's like cookies or gummy bears. And that kind of stuff gets really scary if you're not properly regulating it as far as like health is concerned, because you know kids, right?
It's, all of a sudden. I've just eaten 27 gummy bears. Yeah, that's a bad thing.
Kids are enough work. I don't think it's really great to have a high kid running around. So, right?
Right. I agree. I'm thinking of my own right now. Yeah, that would be interesting. Yeah.
And we got to keep in mind, too, one big difference between, I don't know the exact numbers about how many people smoke weed here. I don't have that on me. But one big difference between Canada and the U.S. is that here, that illegal consumption of marijuana, when it was illegal, is actually, it's, you know, you can get lung cancer and all that from marijuana. Actually, it's mm-hmm. Per joint, it's a multiple. I don't know that number based on a cigarette, right? So when our healthcare is getting paid for by the government, essentially lifetime weed smokers, or what do you call them, stoners or whatever, not anymore. Now we call them, I guess, just everybody or normal, right?
They call him Bob. But, yeah.
Right. Now we just call him Bob. But when your health care is being paid for by the government, if you're not taxing that and getting tax revenue on that, essentially somebody could be smoking marijuana their whole life, end up with some sort of cancer or lung cancer, and the system has to absorb those costs, right? Whereas when you look at cigarettes, I don't know. What's a pack of cigarettes in
Johnston today? Let's see. I don't even know. That's how bad. That's how long it's been since my father smoked. I don't even know what an average price per pack is.
It's
It might be about $5 would be my
guess.
So
here it'd be $15, $16.
Yeah. Right now in North Carolina, the average retail price is $4.87, North Dakota $4.82. So yeah, $4 to $5.
Yeah, so $15, $16, and a lot of that's just taxes based on, you know, if you're going to smoke and we're going to pay for your health care, you're going to have to pay your weight on that, right?
Right.
And so that's, I think, the big thing that a lot of people wouldn't have any disagreement with marijuana, too, is that illegal consumptions actually can add a bearing on our healthcare system. And especially when it's not regulated and you start, you know, getting, I don't know, what do you call it when it's, when there's other stuff in there? I don't know, whatever you call it, when it's laced. There you go.
Oh, laced. Sure.
And then all of a sudden that ends up being, you know, you smoke laced weed and you get a free trip to the hospital still, right? So by regulating it, I think that's the big catch, right?
That's the thing. You know, in the United States, we always look at your national, is it called nationalized healthcare? Is that the way to refer to it, or just healthcare for all? How do you?
I call it the doctor.
But I mean, we say, well, do you want to be like Canada where everything's paid for? And we have a guy.
Universal?
Universal. We have a guy here that's from Canada that works in our building. And he says, yeah, that free healthcare is fine. But my dad, who his parents are back home, he says, dad had to wait, you know, a ridiculous amount of time to get his knee replaced. And, you know, we Americans love things quick. We need burgers in 4 minutes or less, or we're extremely upset. So we have no patience, and we certainly don't have it when it comes to medical, and that's what we pay for, is the convenience of it, to have a doctor on every corner, or every third corner, as it is in some cities.
Now, here in Canada, like, we don't have two-tier system. It's always kind of seems to be a debate whether or not we allow, okay, we have universal, but you can use these other places. But there's nothing, so that doesn't exist right now, but there's really nothing stopping you. Let's say that if I need an operation for a tumor, I can go to the U.S. and pay the same value that you would almost, right?
Right.
And get that operation done across the border still. So there's still that way to get rid of the weight, and that is done at times, which is good for the U.S. I guess hospital industry or whatever you want to call it. But
you mentioned Trudeau, and we've featured him on our program, and also your trade representative Christine Freeland. We saw a lot of them this summer as we in the United States were listening to the president talk about redoing NAFTA and the New Deal, the USMCA. What was the press like during those negotiations with the United States in, say, August and September? What was the news coverage like?
Oh, a lot of that was focused on milk here. And the reason for that is, and, you know, some people say that that was overblown to some extent, too. But the reason for that is because of how big the automobile industry is here, right? And the fears behind tariffs on automobiles and what that would mean if an agreement wasn't made. And essentially, a lot of the articles that I read always seem to say the exact same thing. I mean, is it worth keeping the dairy industry fully protected and lose, you know, or have threats on an automobile industry that's even affects a lot more lives? In theory, but realistically, arguably, even with that milk thing, you can argue it any way that you want about how many jobs that affects. I'm not going to get into all that. I'm not going to say my bias, but that seemed to you got to be careful on stuff,
yeah,
right, Paul?
But, well, you solicited comments ahead of our discussion, and even on just a friendly thing, hey, I mean, do you get, you know, I won't call it hate mail, but strong opinions on both sides? Do you hear from people on both sides of issues like that, like dairy?
Not as much anymore. I think it kind of sobered up to an extent. I mean, I you know, there's four things, I guess. What are they all? When you go to a dairy farmer's property, you don't talk about politics, religion. I guess here it would also be windmills and then quota. Or NAFTA, right?
Right. Like,
but the perception across the industry is kind of, in the big picture, is kind of mixed to some extent. some producers more focused on grain, interestingly, told me that they would have rather seen larger market access and all that. And now that happens, right? With their concern being about land rent and whatever. So there's that side about it. And again, that's not my opinion, anybody listening. So, and then you also have it from a dairy farmer perspective, just wondering, okay, like you gave us a big hit on our production. What does that mean for the U.S. dairy farmer, really? And probably not too much, Paul. What do you think? I mean,
no, and I don't think about it either. Or I shouldn't say I say what I think, but I think you're right. You know, the stories, I read some of those stories in dairy regions that even in the United States, when you talk about what you don't talk about, what's your thoughts on quota, you do the same thing here. Even in Iowa, we think differently from farm to farm, from dairy to dairy about which do you want, which do you care more about. We can't even decide in this state. I know from somebody that inside the dairy trade organization told me that, a big name media outlet's coming out to do a story, and they said, hey, could you give us any farms to go visit and talk to with the owners? And they were like, yeah, what's the angle of your story? Because they had to figure out which dairies to send them to,
right,
that were going to talk, well, A, intelligently about that issue, but then maybe not trash the industry as a whole. But there, it is incredibly sensitive around dairy barns about how you feel about, yeah, I need access, or no, you're dumping it, or no, you're
right,
you're doing something else that's killing me and my family. That, and we've milked dairy cows for seven generations, and this is the last one. I don't know. Did you see that story in Wisconsin this summer? It was right around the discussions with NAFTA and USMCA about the Wisconsin dairies that were having GoFundMe accounts to keep their dairies operational.
Right. And this is where the argument here in Canada would be made on that part, is like, here we have a supply management system that helps control that problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it pretty much, it would stop that type of situation from happening. I mean, the quota's high enough, somebody's going to get out of the market and then open it up for other farmers, right?
Right.
So the argument here is always, is overproduction in the U.S. really our fault from a Canadian standpoint? I'm not sure. I'm not going to answer that question. You tell me, Paul.
I'm not going to either.
But I'm going to play it safe.
Yes, same here. But you told me earlier, you think maybe soybeans was a bigger issue out of this trade deal. Is that right? Did I hear you right?
When you're talking about trade, I mean, especially with grain producers, it's when you're talking about trade and the effects, it's a lot on the U.S.-China more than it is on what happened with NAFTA or whatever you call it.
Yeah, what we did call it, yeah.
The hardest abbreviation to quickly say ever.
Yeah.
But like here, I mean, in the U.S., you got this government bailout, if you would, or the first round anyways. Here in Canada, like, we're still using our futures off of that, off the same price that you are. Our basis has appreciated to some extent, backed off a little bit since then. So for a while that was helping out, but we're not getting that payout. And that would be the same with hogs too, right?
Correct.
And so and to some extent, what's happening that would make producers a little bit uneasy about this whole trade stuff, and I think that might have upset a lot more people that way, is that something that the U.S. is putting their fingers in is directly affecting their operation here.
Okay. Well, that, you know, I just looked at a chart, I think it was Monday or maybe, and then I re-looked at it today, looking at exports, and there was discussion on our show over time, you know, each analyst, every once in a while we get a question, pose it to the analyst about, well, are we just going to funnel grain to Canada and then you're going to ship it to and sell it to China? Have you heard anything in that nature, that there's going to be more U.S. grain coming across the border and then we'll end up in China with your stamp on it from your country?
Yeah, I mean, is that going to be the newspaper headline in China? Typically, let's say that we're around 7 or 8 million metric tons of soybeans. Is that going to be the headline? Like, Canada produces record 25 million metric tons? Like, I think at the end of the day, we have to be realistic on how much difference something like that actually makes, right? And we're seeing that same type of thing in Argentina too, right?
Correct.
It's not just Canada that's isolated there, but...
Well, yeah, it's like
you
all
kind of get where I'm going.
Yeah, it's all of a sudden, oh, Argentina is our number one export market. And for some reason, those shipments never actually touch the ground in Argentina. So they just keep on, wave them on through. So there's ways of getting around things. China is still getting beans. But one of the discussions we've had here is, well, maybe the U.S. tariffs just were an accelerant to what China was already trying to do. It just forced China to say, yeah, you know what? We need to grow our own soybeans and our own hogs. So now that we've got these tariffs, fine. We're just going to do it quicker than we had wanted to. But maybe that's what's going to come out of this. We were headed down that direction. And maybe just President Trump's tariff actions just pushed us there quicker. Is that, would you agree with that?
Yeah, we were already seeing the trend away from the U.S. into Brazil well before this, in the last couple of years too, right?
Right.
So, well, while we're not going to be near what we were previously, it was a trend that was already established prior. And this is still a pile of musical chairs. We don't really know where this is really going to end up. We see those musical chairs with Argentina like we were discussing too, right?
Right.
But I think realistically, positive news would be if China decides that the U.S. and China are best friends again and then buy all their soybeans like Trump tweeted 6 months ago, right?
Right.
I think that's what he tweeted.
Yeah.
So that's the other catch. He tweeted that 6 months ago. And so today's tweet's it's no outlier. But mind you, by the time you put this online or whatever, there could be totally different.
Well,
it could be.
Yeah, and I'm putting a major risk of putting this on election day because what is said on Monday versus what's going to be said on Wednesday and the ramifications of could be completely different. And we will see. So I guess we'll use the old phrase, as we sit here today, this is what the picture looks like. A couple last things here, Matt, before I let you go. So people, do you ever come to the United States to speak or come in to visit? And are there places that you like to go?
I tend to try and make it to the Midwest at least once or twice a year to kind of take a look. Like last spring, I was down in Iowa, and probably this winter, I might be as well. It's tough to say, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm probably going to be on your market to market show sometime in the next couple months too, I hear. So I'm kidding.
You never know. Well, when we start talking about weed futures, we'll go to our special senior correspondent, Matthew Pott, and no, his name is not changed. That's that's what you were born with, right? That's not a TV name.
I guess that's fitting, right?
Yeah, that is. So describe, Ontario, when we had Phil Shaw and I had him describe what his area is like. I mean, where you're at, you're about the same parallel as Minneapolis, right?
Yeah, me and Phil would only be, I don't even know, an hour and a half, 2 hours apart, around the same, latitude.
Yeah.
Longitude? What is that? Latitude.
I think it's latitude.
I always get them backwards.
Yeah.
So we kind of go right in the U.S. pretty far. I mean, part of California would be more north than Ontario, right?
Correct.
And realistically, in a lot of ways, Ontario, at least southwestern Ontario, would be, if you draw a circle around the whole Midwest, it's practically part of the Midwest, right?
Right.
It kind of sticks right in there.
Yeah.
So,
and that's why
we grow the exact same things too,
right? And I think that's why we've gained a lot more Canadian followers on our Twitter, and I followed more of them back because I think it's of interest to see what's going on there, and I think people need to know it's not just the I states that are doing what you do. There's plenty of other people growing the corn, wheat, and soybeans. So, well, good. Well, I appreciate you taking the time out to visit with us, and nice to put a voice. Oh, before I forget, have you actually met Phil?
Yeah, I know Phil. We meet all the time for coffee. We're good friends.
Do you?
Coffee and lunch. He is real. But he looks a lot like the Bank of Governor, Bank of Canada governor. So if you Google that, so we often wonder if they're actually the same person. So he's real, but we don't know how many what he all does, if he's like Superman, right? Super economist, if you will. But
what do you call him? The Bank of Governor or Bank of Canada's
Bank
governor?
Bank of Canada's governor, Stephen Poloz. If you Google it afterwards and look at a picture of Stephen Poloz and then pull up Phil Shaw's
Well, he's in your Twitter. This is the same guy that's in your Twitter feed. Yeah, absolutely. I thought, wow, he's got a picture of Phil on his feed. No, that's Stephen Poloz. That's incredible. They are one and the same.
So we think. We don't know. I mean, Phil farms, right?
Yeah.
But does he also do that?
Does he also do banking?
I don't know.
Good points. Matt, thank you so much.
Thanks, Paul. Have a wonderful day.
Please send us your comments or guest ideas to market2market, it's all one word, at iptv.org. I'm Paul Yeager. Thanks for listening to this production from Iowa Public Television.